This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Writer, actor, and Marine veteran Benjamin Bush will be at Western Michigan University on Wednesday. Coming up, he discusses the transition from combat to civilian life. But first, over the last decade, the Kalamazoo Promise has inspired much discussion, some research into how it works, imitators across the country, and now, at least, two books. Michelle Miller Adams is a research fellow at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo and also a political science professor at Grand Valley State University. She wrote The Power of a Promise, published in 2009. Miller Adams' latest book, available through the Upjohn Institute website, is called Promise Nation, Transforming Communities Through Place-Based Scholarships. Michelle Miller Adams, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Gordon, for inviting me.
What can we say for certain now 10 years after the announcement of the Kalamazoo Promise?
That's a hard question, but one thing we can say for certain is that the Kalamazoo Promise has been a really powerful inspiration to lots of different kinds of communities around the country to try something similar. I think that's one of the biggest surprises of the Promise, that it has spawned this population of dozens of place-based scholarship programs. And they're all different, but they resemble each other in certain respects. So I thought in this book, it made sense to try to take a crack at studying them as a group.
As these other communities have started their own program, what differences do you see? How do different communities get at the idea of a promise, and how do they do it in ways that are maybe not quite like what we have in Kalamazoo?
Right. So I've given this a lot of thought because quite literally every one of these programs differs in some specific points. I've tried with my colleagues and my own thinking to create some categories, ways of thinking about this population of promise programs. And I think they vary along two key dimensions. The first one is which students are covered. And the second one is which post-secondary schools they can attend. Now, Kalamazoo has this very generous, long-term, flexible program where basically if any student meets the minimal four-year enrollment and residency requirements, they will get a scholarship, and they can use it to attend now one of 59 public and private institutions in the state of Michigan. That is both what we would call universal in terms of the students who are covered, and then expansive in terms of where they can go to school. You also have programs that are targeted towards certain groups of students. Most often, these have various merit requirements, usually GPA requirements, often attendance requirements, sometimes community service requirements. Occasionally, there will be targeting on the basis of financial need, but interestingly, that is not the dominant approach in these place-based scholarship programs. And on the other dimension, where students can go to school, there's one program that's even more flexible than ours. The El Dorado Promise lets students take their scholarship at the maximum in-state public tuition rate and use it anywhere in the country. But many programs limit use of the scholarship to a local community college or a group of local community colleges. So across those two dimensions, which students can use the scholarship, where they can take it to attend their post-secondary education, those are really critical variables. There's obviously also the issue of funding, but most of these programs are funded through some combination of philanthropy, generous individual donors, generous business donors. There's not a lot of public funding of place-based scholarship programs. There's a little bit, but not a lot.
When we interviewed Tim Bartik, who is also a colleague of yours at the Upjohn Institute, recently published research about the educational effects of the promise, along with a couple of other Upjohn Institute researchers, one of the things he made a point about is that if you were to have a program which requires a 3.5 GPA and says you can take your scholarship to a community college, he questions whether that's truly a promise-like program. When you're drawing the boundaries around what you consider a true promise-like program, are there some things where you think after a while it really does not equate to what is being done in Kalamazoo, or it's so far from it that you really don't consider it in the same universe?
Right. So I've tried to come up with a definition of promise programs that will encompass this broad degree of variation, but also has something meaningful about it. And for me, I guess the important thing is to look at the intention or the goals of the creators or the stakeholders in these programs. So for me, promise programs are about more than just sending more students to get a higher education. They have some transformative element, and usually that includes transformation of the school district to try to build what people often call a college-going culture, increase college knowledge, college readiness, and also at some level to transform the community by making the community more attractive, by making it a stronger magnet for people who care about education to move in, about aligning the community around education as a central piece of the economic development strategy. So I look for those transformative elements. And most of the programs that we look at do include seeking to increase access to higher education, seeking to transform the K-12 school district, and seeking in some way to transform the community. Now, some of them, their program rules, the one you mentioned is, you know, particularly extreme example, and it's a real example. They really don't make sense given those transformative goals. Most promise programs, about half of them are universal in terms of eligibility. The other half have some kind of usually merit requirement. It's usually more like a 2.5 or 2.0 GPA cutoff. I am a big fan of universal programs because if you are really trying to expand opportunity and if you limit the program to the higher achieving students, you are, because of the nature of our educational system, cutting out a disproportionate number of low-income and usually minority students. So those programs tend to serve the students who are already headed to a post-secondary education.
One of the things you come back to several times in Promise Nation is the idea that the Kalamazoo Promise is simple, that is a strength of the system. But is there a trade-off between simplicity and, say, trying to target lower-income students who would be the ones who would probably not go on to college without a program like this? Whereas you say, some of the other students who benefit were likely to go to college anyway.
Universal programs tend to be simpler. The trade-off is really financial. There is some money that the Kalamazoo Promise is sending students to college who would have gone anyway. I would argue that there's still tremendous benefits to those students. Perhaps they're getting to attend a more selective, more expensive institution. Perhaps they're graduating with less debt. Perhaps they'll be able to now go on to graduate school with some student loans. So there are some positive benefits. There is some positive benefits to the spending, but the lack of targeting that you mentioned is a concern to a lot of people. A lot of people from the student financial aid field really believe that financial aid should be targeted on the basis of need. And we do have an extreme example of that in the federal Pell Grant program, where it's very much targeted toward people below a certain income level, but it's also extremely hard to apply for. I'm sure all of our listeners know and have heard about the complexities of filling out the FAFSA. A great deal of student financial aid is left on the table because of those barriers to entry. So for me, one of the attractions of simplicity, the fact that the Kalamazoo Promise application fits easily on one piece of paper, can be filled out by a student, him or herself, is that it lowers not just the financial barrier, but it lowers the barrier to accessing financial aid. So it brings down multiple barriers to higher education, which really does improve the uptake among low-income students. And my colleague's data does bear that out. The Kalamazoo Promise is being used across all demographic groups, across all income groups at roughly the same level. Now, students from different demographic groups are attending different types of institutions, but the barriers to entry are low. So I'm a big fan of simplicity. If you can't explain your program in a couple of sentences, maybe 20 seconds, there's going to be a lot of confusion about it.
To play devil's advocate, the guy who is trying to get some sort of place-based scholarship in any town USA may not have donors quite as generous or as wealthy as the ones who have supplied the money for the Kalamazoo Promise and may say, I've got limited resources. If I've got to pick and choose what I'm going to do with it, I'd rather help that student who is not likely to go to college because the cost is going to get in the way. Is there anything wrong with that argument?
No, this is what I would recommend to those people. And in fact, this is what I recommend to those people. Create a universal scholarship program that allows students to do their first 2 years of post-secondary education tuition-free at a community college. Your upper-income students are not likely to go to that local community college. They may go off and use their family resources or take out loans, but your lower-income students are going to be able to attend a local community college tuition-free, get a high-value certificate or an associate's degree, possibly transfer on to a four-year institution. Your middle-income students, too, will often choose to attend a community college for their first couple of years of education. Really cuts down on the cost of that higher education. Those programs are extremely low cost to operate. The reason, of course, is that federal financial aid for low-income students covers the entire cost of tuition.
One of the things you write about in the book Promise Nation is that, yes, several communities almost immediately after the Kalamazoo Promise was announced said, okay, this sounds like a great idea. We're going to do our own version. But some of those never really got off the ground, never became full-blown scholarship programs. What happened? How come there were some places that never could really make this work?
It's different from community to community, but I would say that if I had to pick one reason, oddly enough, it's not the money. It is the process by which a community embraces a scholarship program. It's in the book, I call it community alignment. Sometimes I call it community engagement. Many of these efforts were not deeply rooted in stakeholders across the community. Kalamazoo is very unusual. This program was developed, cooked up by the donors in private, announced to the community, already fully baked and fully funded. No other community has had that happen to it. The programs have been created by stakeholders in the community and funding sought from within that community. And if you do not have deep engagement and investment across the community in doing this, if people in the community don't feel that these programs are really going to respond to that community's critical need, you're not going to have the support, the leadership support, the public support, and ultimately the funding to make them work.
I want to come back to the title of this book, Promise Nation. And I wonder if you are implying or mean to imply that with all of the pressures we have at play right now, the cost of going to college, the rising student debt, the fact that you are much more likely to land into a career which pays well if you have some sort of post-secondary education, is that leading us all to a time where it will be more likely that a community has some sort of promise-based scholarship program than that they don't have it?
I do. I think there is so much innovation and experimentation right now around this issue. The landscape is changing very quickly. And that's one reason why I wrote this book, is to kind of lay out that landscape, what's happening at the state level. We now have two states, really one and one to some extent, Tennessee and Oregon, that have committed to making community college largely free for all of their residents. We have initiatives at the federal level. President Obama proposed an America's College Promise in his State of the Union last year. I don't think anyone expects it to become law anytime soon, but the conversation is really moving in that direction. We have some very broad-based non-governmental organizations and campaigns that are pushing this idea of making at least the first 2 years of post-secondary education tuition-free. And so the conversation in the time that between my first book and this book, the conversation has changed dramatically. And what I really value about some of these initiatives is that they're not rigid, they're not one size fits all. They're quite encompassing and flexible, saying, whatever way communities can get there, or states or municipalities can get there, we have 10 communities in Michigan, 9 communities in Michigan that are Michigan Promise Zones, where students have at least access to the first 2 years of community college for free. This multiplicity and pluralism of approaches is really exciting. It's really promising. It's really American. We innovate at the local level. And then ideas bubble up. They bubble over to different states and different communities and up to the national level. And that's where we are right now in this period of policy innovation and experimentation around free college.
You've mentioned that to date, almost all of the Promise programs are funded with private money. Would it be another step if we started seeing more debate even about the idea that there should be some public money that is a public good that people should pay for out of their tax dollars?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that conversation is beginning. The Michigan Promise Zones themselves, one of the three funding pillars of those Promise Zones is a portion of the state education tax. In Tennessee and in Oregon, those statewide programs are being publicly funded. And there are a few Promise programs here and there that have some element of public funding. So it's harder, it's a tougher sell, but it's certainly where the conversation is going.
Michelle Miller-Adams, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Michelle Miller-Adams is a research fellow at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, a political science professor at Grand Valley State University, and the author of Promise Nation, Transforming Communities Through Place-Based Scholarships. You can find links with more information at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Benjamin Bush is a writer. He has contributed to Harper's and other publications. His memoir, Dust to Dust, was published in 2013. Bush is an actor. He had a regular role in the TV series The Wire during its last three seasons. He is a filmmaker and a Marine veteran who served two tours of duty in Iraq. Benjamin Bush will be at Western Michigan University on Wednesday, Veterans Day, for a talk called Homefront Debriefings, The Lives of Veterans in the 1st Civilian Division. Benjamin Bush, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the question of just coming back home. How hard is it when you have seen everything that you might see in combat to then sort of be back at the grocery store or back perhaps at your child's school or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's probably the one good thing that the Hurt Locker got right was when he's standing in that aisle and he can't make a decision about which cereal to choose. You know, he's had so many kind of profound decisions to make, and then suddenly the mundane becomes almost overwhelming in its lack of consequence. I think that's the biggest thing that's difficult to adapt to, is that you change to different consequences, different responsibilities. Returning from my first combat tour, I had left my wife at home, my family. And my second tour was much different because I left a baby at home with her. And I think all veterans go through this, whether we're talking about a universe that particularly focuses on the combat veteran. And I think to the exclusion of the largest of the veteran experience, which is non-combat, it's just the simple participation in the military, which most of our service members in uniform are part of. But all of it involves this strange severance from family, whether it's just for training or domestic posting or not. We leave our environment, usually at a very young age, you know, right after high school, for officers right after college. And combat was one of those strange environments where I kind of had to prepare not to return. You know, you talk about some people thinking about home all the time, and everyone adapts to that disappearance from your other life differently. But in my case, on my second tour especially, after I'd been wounded and remained in Ramadi, which was a very cruel world in 2005, as it is now, it's controlled by the Islamic State. And I kind of had to give in to the reality that I wasn't coming back. And then to survive and return, I almost had to create a whole new acceptance of the world that I was in. I kind of planned to leave it already. And that was a very difficult part of returning, was coming back from all that pressure to an absence of pressure like that, the absence of imminent danger.
How mindful can you be of what your absence does to your family, your wife, and your kids as opposed to just kind of focusing on getting yourself right? Is there time to think about the family, or is the focus on just you getting through day to day when you get back from a combat mission?
I think it's a great question. And I think we have a myopic fixation on the veteran, as if everyone has trauma, which most don't. And we forget the fact that while they were gone, their families were incapable of, first of all, feeling what those veterans were going through, seeing it in a real visceral sense. And their only hope was for the safety of their loved one. And they couldn't participate in that safety. You know, the parents' job in life is to protect their child. And war takes that child from the parent and does not allow the parent to participate in their safety. And it's incredibly difficult for a parent to go through, for a lover, for a spouse, for children. The sense of dependency is very, very different. And we don't look at the families. We kind of all feel that we have to rally around the veteran upon the return, and we do. But there's equal pressure. There's the wish for survival. There's the worry over this kind of imaginary land that the veteran's living in by the families that we simply don't really acknowledge. We don't support. And we finally rushed to kind of understand the heavy burden of some of these experiences on veterans, but we still have left the families out of this.
As someone who did a couple different tours in Iraq, is it tougher to get yourself in the mindset to actually go into combat, or is it tougher to get into the civilian mindset when you get back home?
I found it far more difficult to adapt to civilian sensibilities after I had essentially discarded them in favor of combat sensibilities. You know, you return home, and especially from Iraq, where we had so many explosive devices planted along the roadways, you know, you regard trash in a totally new way, just along a regular street. There's a new suspicion of your environment, and we take our world for granted that it's not going to kill us most of the time. And a lot of veterans don't have that shared belief anymore for a while. It takes some time to kind of allow for just the general landscape not to be a threat. And I think that was hard for me to adapt to, just on a personal level. My suspicions remained pretty high for a long time. But I think that's part of the experience. I think preparing for combat is something that you train for. You know, I went through years and years of preparing for that event, for that kind of trouble. And honestly, I was far less, I guess, psychologically jarred by its actual arrival because of that preparation and because of the singular focus you have. In life, you know, in Kalamazoo, you don't usually have singular focuses. You have a day where you have to accomplish certain errands. And there's an awful lot of time built into that. In combat, you have one thing to worry about. You know, you're searching for an enemy at all times. And your tasks are so specific. I think it's a hard thing for a veteran to adapt to is that real sense of urgency and sense of purpose.
You wrote in the foreword to the book, Standing Down from Warrior to Civilian, about how discharge is such an appropriate word for what happens when you leave the military, because the soldier very suddenly goes from combat to civilian life. In some ways, is it almost too abrupt of a change for that person who actually has been in combat?
I think so. And I think the military has also incorporated a better sense of time afterwards. In the reserves, not much at all. I think the reserves are the ones that really had it the worst because they came directly from a far more civilian life. They were thrown directly into the immersion in military life, and then we're thrown right back into civilian life again. Most active duty, you know, they train for war all the time. Then they deploy to it, and then return to a base which is filled with veterans, filled with similar experience, whereas reservists are thrown right back into the ecosystem. You know, they're thrown back into a dilution of people who have no shared experience, have no shared perspective on what just happened. And I think for them it's very difficult because it's such a profound transition. There is no air built into that. And I kind of describe, I think, you know, talking about coming from deep water, you know, divers have to return to the surface very, very slowly or they will die. You simply can't change pressure that quickly. The physical body can't adapt to it. And the mind can't either. And I think this is something where we go to the mind as much as the body. You're suddenly released from those pressures into, you know, shopping again and mowing lawns and regular life, which despite its stresses on everybody else who doesn't serve in the military, they're very different stresses. I think you're onto something with that strange transition and sometimes it being far too quick. So I think one thing that rescues us, and I'll certainly talk about this when I'm in Kalamazoo, is that the arts create that space where we can begin to interpret our experience. We can begin to find pieces of our experience in the work of others who have been trying to express it.
Have you found that when you've come back, the creative outlets you have, you know, as a writer, as an actor, and maybe not everybody is in quite your universe here. They're not the son of a novelist, and they may not get on an HBO series like The Wire. But is there something to the idea that having a place to perhaps express yourself creatively helps you deal with what you saw in combat and helps you deal with that transition back to being a civilian?
I think the arts help everyone deal with everything. I think we're all either listeners or storytellers, but in the end, we all respond to story. And we all have one. You know, people will talk about, there's so many veterans who are not combat veterans. I mean, 90% of them are not combat veterans, probably a higher percentage even. That doesn't make less of anything they've been through. They have changed their environment and their lives. They've moved, been transplanted, been uprooted. For a period of time, you don't own your life. You're given orders. They aren't called requests. And so I think storytelling is kind of a primal thing. If I can do this right, you know, what I want is to make a fire we can all gather around. And everyone has their turn. I don't know that any one particular genre satisfies what I'm trying to articulate. I think I've certainly been dealing with my combat experiences, but also just my experience in childhood. The journey of a life is filled with experiences, some of them traumatic without going anywhere. You know, I lost my parents. That's about as bad as it gets. You know, whether it was a heart attack or a bullet, loss has similarities everywhere in everyone's life. And I've found that language has been incredibly important to me. If we can inspire, even if they aren't going to write, if we can inspire some people to read things which have been written about their experiences, and maybe in that, find something which speaks to them, find something that makes them no longer alone, then I say we win. So I'm always going to back the arts when it comes to our own health.
Benjamin Bush, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Benjamin Bush is a writer, filmmaker, actor, and Marine veteran. He will speak about the Talking Service Program at Western Michigan University on Wednesday, Veterans Day. You can find links with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.